Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and while it was no G1 Climax, I thought that this year's SummerSlam was a hell of a show, and usually a pay-per-view featuring blood, urine, vomit and 15 Germans is not my idea of a good time.
Hi, I'm G. John Chase, and my favourite NWO alumni is Scott Hall, I am Wolfpack for life, and I think that the finger poke of doom is deadlier than the diamond cutter.
I'm Carl Jones, and I share the same hair replacement therapist as Hulk Hogan. I'm the only person to date to actually lose weight on the Buddy Rose blowaway diet, and I'd like to take this opportunity to inform the rest of the members of the panel that I will be unavailable for podcasts next year during softball season.
And I'm Luke Edwards, and I once turned my back on the wolf pack. I ended up in a small village somewhere near Stoke-on-Trent. Could have been worse. I might have wound up in a body bag.
This is the panel for the 12th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the positives and negatives of the NWO next.
The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hello everyone and welcome to the 12th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
How's it hanging?
Along with Carl Jones.
NWO, no NWO, I'm always hearing the poor music.
And Luke Edwards.
I'm taking over.
BWO reference, you swore you were going to get in.
It'll do.
Well, it's a very interesting podcast today. We've got so much feedback to get to. The subject, as you all know, judging by the music at the start of the show, is the New World Order. We posed the question to a number of different forums, to everybody that listens. Do the positives of the NWO outweigh the negatives? And that's brought on a lot of feedback that we're going to get to on this show. But that was really just an excuse for us all to dive in headfirst with a topic about the New World Order. Carl, a few podcasts ago, I think it was on the Overrated podcast, when somebody suggested the NWO, said that this could be a whole other podcast, that we could dedicate the entire podcast to the NWO. We are, if nothing else, a show for the people. So here we are, talking about the New World Order. And just before we get into everybody's feedback and talking about the New World Order itself, first of all, for you folks at home, if you don't know what the New World Order is, I'm not sure how you found this podcast, really. there's only going to be so much description of the whole thing that we're going to do. We'll get to bits and pieces of it, obviously. But just around the table, your experience, time and place, what was your involvement in wrestling? Just so that people know our perspectives of, you know, dealing with the NWO at the time or retroactively.
Well, I personally always consider myself a WWF guy. As a kid, I'd always watch that religiously. Until my mother decided that money was an important thing. Mm. And so she cut off the sky.
It's always a bastard.
It is. Really, really sticks in your crawl, doesn't it?
You never forget.
No, absolutely not. But we were still able to get a couple of channels. One was the Cartoon Network, which after 6 o'clock at night, for anyone in the UK who remembers it, became TNT. And being TNT meant we'd always get Nitro every Friday from 6 o'clock. And so because we didn't have Sky at the time, and I wasn't able to watch Raw or any WWF, I was pretty much focused solely on WCW, watching Nitro every Friday night. And I sort of came into WCW around the same time as the NWO angle formed. I just remember at the time just being sort of completely gobsmacked by it. You know, I grew up being a Hulkamaniac, loved Hulk Hogan, training, prayers, vitamins, all that business. Used to do the mock promos as a kid with pretending to rip the vest.
You were actually a Hogan guy, I didn't know that.
I was a Hogan guy as a child.
I didn't know that.
Shockingly, I was. So to see Hulk Hogan as a heel just completely blew my mind. And then you've got Hall and Nash, who I think they've mentioned it, enough talking heads have mentioned it on the WWF DVDs. That's Razor and that's Diesel. And they're in WCW. And Hogan's a bad guy. Just completely blew my mind. And I'm absolutely hooked on it. Little did we know how it would spiral. But like you said before, we'll get to that a bit later on. So I will give the floor to someone else now to pass on their initial memories.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not going to get too deep into the memories, but in terms of what my perspective was at the time, I was a fan of wrestling pretty much non-stop since I got into it. So I was watching WCW Worldwide on ITV up until 1995 when they dropped it. And of course, WCW Nitro, like you mentioned, was on TNT, and I was getting to see tapes of it every week, pretty much starting with the Scott Hall episode, funnily enough. My good friend Ashley Griffiths, who's listening to this right now, would tape it for me, and I'd always get to see it. So I got to see it every week, as it happened?
Well, I was also WWF-based growing up. I think, as kids do, you tend to disregard the competition to some extent, whether they deserve it or not. And it was very much, you know, Nintendo-Sega kind of thing. But, yeah, I didn't watch much WCW until into the NWO's run, to the point where it was the bloat had begun for the NWO.
Yeah.
And looking back, at the time I didn't get it, you know, because apparently I wasn't there when it was great. And so when I saw NWO, they were nothing special to me. Maybe if I got in there beforehand, maybe it would have changed my opinion on that. But retrospectively, I find the NWO curiosity. But I wasn't there in their best days.
Gee, from what I understand, you had fallen out of wrestling. Similar Sky issues to Carl, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely right. I mean, my parents cancelled the Sky, and I pretty much remained discommunicated from wrestling for quite a few years and came back into it in 99. So unfortunately, I'm the retrospective guy on this podcast.
Not that that's a bad thing.
No, not at all, because we need that guy, and that's me. But yeah, so I actually, funny enough, because when we started getting WCW on Channel 5 in 99...
Oh God.
Oh, that wasn't good.
Boom, bang,
Biff,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
For those of
yeah.
you who don't know, by the way, just give a little bit of context. Yeah. For some reason, Channel 5 decided to put Batman, Biff, Pow signs over any kind of weapon show or anything they deemed remotely violent.
But yeah, like, funnily enough, the first episode, if I remember right, I think the first episode that they did show on Channel 5, I think was the actual episode where the last remnants of the NWO angle was finished. And so I went, you know, on the internet, and just lo and behold, like, just pages, like websites all over the place, and pages upon information. And I sat there for an entire evening reading through, like, this chronological order of what happened in WCW with the NWO. And so that was actually how I kind of learned all about it. I actually read about it first.
Okay, now there's a lot of different aspects to the New World Order that we can get to in terms of the execution of the beginning, in terms of how many members they had, how it ended, or lack thereof, when it should have ended. And pretty much all of this is going to come through in the feedback, so why not start there? DMJ from Pro Wrestling Only, again, the question, did the positives outweigh the negatives of the NWO? We can all give our feedback and our opinion on that question at the end of the show. But DMJ says, the birth of the NWO revitalized wrestling in America. It led to a career rebirth for Hulk Hogan and remarkable matches and storylines for everyone from Randy Savage and Shawn Waltman to NWO rivals like Lex Luger and Diamond Dallas Page. For more than a year, we saw the WWE forced to push their own creative juices to keep up with WCW, a true competition between two promotions, the likes of which we'd never seen before as fans. While, in the end, no one could applaud the booking of the show, if you were a wrestling fan, the build-up to Starrcade 97 was thrilling in a way that hadn't been experienced in years. Meanwhile, in the aforementioned WWE, without the NWO, Vince McMahon has no impetus to update his own show with more adult-oriented storylines and characters. Without that, we get Rocky Maivia the Blue Chipper and not The Rock. We get Shawn Michaels the Boy Toy and Hunter Hearst Helmsley the Blue Blood and not the Generation X. Without the middle fingers, beers, and DTA attitude, what does Stone Cold Steve Austin look like? Probably the ringmaster, I would imagine. The NWO brought must-see back to professional wrestling. Led to competition that raised the stakes for both companies, and by bringing a spotlight to WCW, even helped make guys like Eddie Guerrero, Steve Regal, Chris Jericho, Rey Mysterio, Psychosis, Raven, and Chris Benoit household names. Sure, it also indirectly led to the downfall of the same company it brought to number one, but had it never existed, who's to say the company would have lasted much longer anyway? And that's actually, I think that last point there that you said is actually an interesting one to get to, because the state of WCW when it began is something I like to kind of bring up, because pre-NWO, we were entering the Monday Night War had just begun at the end of 1995, but 1995 was a dismal, dreck year for WCW.
Oh, the Yeti?
The Dungeon of Doom.
Oh, God.
The Hogan influence on the product was... It started in 94, and it bled over into a very, very ugly 95.
Well, that was it, and someone who's probably got a stronger handle on the buy rate numbers, all those sort of things, can probably either concur with what I'm saying or disprove it, whatever the case may be. But I got the sense that by 94, you've had that initial spark of Hogan's here. It legitimizes WCW. You get some great buy rates out of it. He pretty much buries Ric Flair and Vader, which is an unfortunate byproduct of Hogan and his numbers. But by the time you get to 95, the luster's already gone. The house show crowds are booing him. He's getting booed on TV. It's audible on those early nitros. It's clearly audible.
That's a big deal. I know that we're not going to be the first one to make this point, but the whole idea that Hogan's heel turn was anything other than a necessity is completely incorrect. It was pretty much the only way to go. Hogan had pretty much exhausted his options in WCW because at the time that Hogan turned heel, he'd been away from the TV, and the product itself had heated up to the point where WCW was actually doing pretty well without Hogan. All of a sudden, he lost a lot of his value, because as a house show draw, the Ric Flair, Randy Savage feud of 1996 when Liz turned heel and joined Ric Flair actually boosted the house shows to a significant degree. From a pay-per-view standpoint, obviously Hogan was did a lot for WCW, but it was becoming more about Monday Nitro, and the focus was there, and Nitro's ratings without Hogan were doing okay.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting time period really in 95, because you just kind of mentioned a few things there that in probably in the eyes of a lot of people kind of legitimized WCW. It kind of made them come across as like, okay, they're an actual contender. But as obviously the popularity of Hogan started to diminish, and as you're saying, the product started getting more and more popular, it was all those like little other things that they did. I mean, that whole Miss Elizabeth turning on Savage and joining Ric Flair, that was good because they were blatantly harking back to the angle that they did together in the WWF.
Yeah.
And so they were just obviously constantly like comparing themselves to the WWF. But yeah, the kind of interesting thing with Hogan is, you can say what you will about him, and we will on this podcast, but when it comes to business and about his own image, there's no one smarter than Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan knows. No.
I will disagree with
Hulk Hogan knows when it comes to himself. He knows when he needed to change. Okay, and he tried to ride the wave for as long as possible. Obviously, he tried to ride the wave, and he initially signed on to WCW for money. Okay, because he signed on for money because his film career was shit. Now,
Are you telling me you didn't enjoy Thunder in Paradise?
Fuck off. That's all I'm going to say about that.
The wit.
But yeah, I mean, Hogan recognised, obviously, that the tide was changing now. And he couldn't come back from this. And so I think it's credit due to Hogan that he turned around. And, he could have turned around and he could have been stubborn and said, no, I'll stay as a babyface. If you don't use me as a babyface, then I'll fucking leave. But he didn't. He stuck around and he said, okay, I see what you're doing here. I can see the potential in this. And so he turned heel. And it was a good business decision by Hogan for himself.
But it was brought on by necessity is the point.
Yeah, it was brought on by necessity.
The thing is, don't get me wrong, you're absolutely right. Hogan has always known what's best for Hogan. Mm. But when it came to the heel turn, let's not pretend he was anything other than reluctant. He didn't want to do it. He was worried about merchandise and all the money that goes along with that. Even Bischoff had his doubts about Hogan turning heel.
Yeah.
If I don't know how much people want to believe Kevin Sullivan on this, but the story goes that such was Hogan's initial reluctance to it that he had to spend the night before the pay-per-view, he slept at Sullivan's house. Sullivan kept him away from everyone.
Yeah. So no one could get in his ear.
No one could get in his ear. No one could say, you can't do this. Think about that, B-rated as those movies are. Think about the movies. Think about the merchandise. He was absolutely reluctant to it. He realised he needed to change. Don't get me wrong. He saw that he was pissing into the wind when it came to Hulk Hogan Ultra Babyface 1996.
Yeah.
But he wasn't fully on board with it. He had to be coaxed and cajoled into that heel turn.
Oh yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. At no point did I think this was an easy decision for Hogan. I think anyone that's in Hogan's position would find it difficult to make that decision, because he said, all his merchandise, his image, whether he did advertisements or films or TV, whatever, it was all based on the fact that he was a babyface. And obviously, coming off that whole being involved in the steroid scandal, he probably didn't want to portray a heel just because, it's not going to do his character to any good.
No, he's got to think about Mr. Nanny too. If he turns heel, there's no sequel.
We're still waiting for Mr. Nanny too. I'm not thinking at any point that he was, it was an easy decision for him. But the fact is, probably most other people would have still buckled at the last minute. But like Hogan didn't, and I always think the credit has to go to Hogan, because it wouldn't be an easy decision when loads of money is on the line and your image. That once you've done that, and if it didn't work, he's kind of fucked. Really, so it's like he had to take the plunge, and he was brave enough and smart enough to do it, and it paid off.
Yeah, it did pay off, and I'm not sure how much Hogan really had to lose with the wrestling audience at the time, because, like you said, Carl, the people were booing him on those early nitros. There was a lot of resistance to Hulk Hogan. This seems like a very good time to talk about the origins of the NWO in terms of the original angles. The Scott Hall debut on Nitro, I'm bringing my big friend here next week, Kevin Nash debuts, and the mystery about who the third man is. Initial thoughts on the way this angle was executed in the very beginning. Luke.
Well, here's the thing. As I said earlier, I didn't catch the start of the angle live at the time.
Yeah.
And because I didn't get that, I missed out on what I think, and I've had described to me by many people, was somewhat of the magic of the NWO, if you will. The authenticity. It's so good that I came up with that word all by myself, isn't it? The authenticity proposed by the angle that I think lent it a lot of credence, which honestly I feel like it may have rode for longer than it deserved, if I'm honest. Looking back now, and I can only look back on it with the eyes of me today, the sadly somewhat jaded wrestling fan today, knowing what I know about Kevin Nash now, knowing what I know about Scott Hall now, and so on, that probably does taint it in my eyes now somewhat.
Really?
Yeah, it really does. Because I've said this in previous podcasts, I have difficulty with people who I genuinely dislike as people. You know, as it were, wrestlers who I genuinely dislike as people, I just don't really care. I'm not invested in. And that gets tricky when it's Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, because you think back to what Diesel and Razor were at the time compared to how we see Scott Hall and Kevin Nash today, looking back. Mm. There's a difference. I don't care who you are. If you know wrestling, if you watch wrestling, you can't see them as the same.
But if I can speak to the authenticity that you referred to there.
That was a good word, by the way. I'm so glad I came up with it.
It was an excellent word. And I'm really glad that someone got you that word a day calendar for Christmas. But going with the authenticity of it, it's the way, and I don't want to sort of constantly repeat the talking heads from DVDs, but you've got this man Hall and this man Nash. They never really refer to them by name. You know, you never get the impression it's part of the show. Obviously, you have Hall coming through the crowd.
Yeah.
These guys could run roughshod over everyone. You got them coming in with a baseball bat.
Yeah, the angle on Nitro from there. Yeah, the upper right, upper right, and upper they can right. balance the crowd.
And you've got the parking lot brawl. You don't really see a lot. In truth, you see some guys on the floor, and you see Ray toss like a lawn dart into the production truck.
Yeah, yeah.
But that speaks that authenticity.
Yeah,
because you know it's very stoic from the commentators. You've got Jimmy Hart running out as a heel. You've got heels side by side, baby faces with heels. Everyone's just sort of converging together, and you think, God, this gives the legitimacy of a gang war. This is desperate stuff. Look, you've got Bagwell on the floor there. You've got Luger and Anderson next to each other in conversation. Sting with Anderson looking over him. Flair's there as well. These are guys you'd
Mongo really, screaming yeah, at the top of
Mongo
his lungs.
Screaming at the top
I
of
can't
his
believe this!
Absolutely. And then you've got, you know, these guys who, any other time you'd have seen them on TV previously to this, they're the other side of the ring facing off against each other. But now, they're in the middle of a gang warfare.
Yeah, the way that they, the weight and the gravity that they gave those initial angles is a lot of what carries it, I think, because that the one that you're specifically mentioning, the brawl backstage at the Disney MGM, is when they're talking about it went for so long, they sold it for so long, the ambulances are coming, they're whisking everybody away, the announcers are talking about it constantly.
I think the key thing with that initial period was that they took their time. They didn't just blow their load straight away. And for me, like when I was watching it back, I'm probably biased because I'm a fan of the guy anyway, but for me, I thought Hall was the best of the three in terms of that initial period. I thought he was the star of that team. I mean, there's a reason why he was the first one out. And so when you're looking at those initial periods, like Carl was saying about, you know, bringing Nash in as well and how he's towering above everyone, just how they built it up, they took their time. You know, Hall comes out, he claims, you know, you want a war, you know, and 2 weeks later, Nash comes in. The following week, they do the whole baseball bat attack. And then, as you guys were saying, the whole incident when they go, like, backstage is just fantastic.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely
that's
fantastic
after Hogan's angle. Joined.
Yeah,
but it's...
yeah. Hogan's joined at Bash at the Beach, and you catch Hall and Nash attacking guys out back. And you see the whole, you know, Rey Mysterio gets thrown like a lawn dart. And, you know, the commentary team is just fantastic how they're selling it, and just everybody. And in particular, you mentioned a lot of names. You mentioned Jimmy Hart running around like a madman and Mongo and Michaels shouting his ass off. For me, the person who sold that the most, and me and Liam were talking about this last night as we were watching that very segment, was Woman.
Woman was awesome in
Woman.
That angle.
Woman.
Ryan!
Yeah. Screaming, yeah.
Woman,
pulling her eyes out.
Arn Anderson is clutching, Dad is clutching his arm and screaming in pain, and she's holding him, she's cradling him, and she's screaming as tears, genuine tears falling down her face, as she's screaming, going, oh my God, oh my God. And for Jenny Murray, you're watching it thinking, oh shit, he's only broke his arm, that's the thing, because it looks like she, you know, he's just been told he's got cancer or something, you know. She's crying, and like, you know, and they're doing the whole thing where Ray is shouting that there was a fourth guy and Eddie and Eddie Guerrero's looking at Alex Wright, the German, and they're just saying like, there's four guys, who's four guys, you know. And it's just like, that angle was so fucking great. It was sold perfectly by everybody there.
And don't forget the one guy we haven't mentioned all this, Macho, acting like an absolute madman, chasing after the limo, trying to dive through the roof,
jumping on top of the driving away limo.
If there was ever a more believable moment, it's that. Like, if you're gonna guess, like, oh, who do you think's gonna run after the limousine and jump on top of a moving car? Savage. It's gonna be Savage every time. I love him.
I wonder if that was planned, or if he just decided to go for it.
Did it? You know, he just did it, and you can tell Nash and Hall are in the limousine going, what the fuck are you doing?
Two different dynamics I want to address here. You mentioned Scott Hall as the guy that you thought was the gem of the first section of the NWO.
Absolutely.
Two things I want to mention here. One is something that we've talked about before in the NWO, in the sense that at first, as much as Scott Hall was a gem and a very good talker, if you watch those early NWO angles, the crowd's chanting Diesel, and they see Nash as a bigger star than Hall, which is interesting, considering they were kind of treated as equals. And the other thing I want to mention with Hogan, and Hogan... At first, Hogan, the great heel turn at Bash at the Beach, the promo of his life.
Oh, yeah.
The best promo he ever did. Yeah, the best promo he ever did. The first one on Nitro was pretty good as well. But when they started doing those, the preceding announcement or the following announcements been paid for by the New World Order segments, Hogan's quite terrible. And when Hogan's on his own in some of these angles, there's a promo at Clash of the Champions on Nitro when he's on his own, where Hogan, he just comes off like a Batman villain. It comes off like he's completely out of touch with why the angle worked at first on some of these video packages.
I think it might have been the actual NWO DVD they released, where I think they said that when they were filming those vignettes, the reason why that they had those distinctive styles of, you know, being in black and white and the quick cuts between like all the little tidbits that they said,
yeah,
was because of how bad Hogan was. And that Hogan would just be running his promo and he'd just be like talking for ages, just running his mouth off, and none of it made sense half the time.
It's just so hokey. It's just at one point, I can't remember, he just bursts out laughing like a crazy, like I said, like a Batman villain.
Yeah, I think it's probably a byproduct of being one of the... being the top guy through the 80s and the way the heels were in the 80s. It was all very cartoonish. It was a more cartoonish decade.
Absolutely.
And then you get into this more realistic decade, if you like, with the 90s, much more sort of cutting edge, cool, if you want to use that phrase. And you don't think of cool and cutting edge when you think Hogan, do you?
No.
So you've got Hall, you've got Nash, and you need them there as the crutches. They're very much sort of the guides, if you like, on either wing of the plane, almost just keeping it on the even keel, yeah, you know, preventing it from nosediving. Which, one hokey Hogan promo, I'm not saying it buries the angle, but it certainly does it a lot of damage.
One more thing I just want to mention before we move on about this initial period was how great that angle at Great American Bash was.
Oh, the powerbomb on Bischoff. Yeah, yeah, I do too.
I mean, that was absolutely fantastic. I mean, again, I'm gonna, you know, put Hall over more than anyone else. Just like when he's talking, it's just great when he's talking about, you know, like, bring your three guys out, you know, and the big size man and the medium size man are gonna carve you up. And, you know, just fucking powerbombs him.
I tell you what,
it was brutal.
It was brutal, and I remember I rewound the tape of that powerbomb about 100 times. That powerbomb, that angle was awesome. Yeah. But there was a funny little side note. Might cut this off if this show goes too long. You know, they actually gimmicked both sides of the ramp for Bischoff to get powerbombed through, just in case they didn't know which one to do. Yeah. And Pedro Morales, after the show, who was doing the Spanish commentary, trod on the table, broke, and like broke his ankle. Is there anything more beautifully that's WCW
great
than that?
Oh, great. Absolutely.
We're gonna have a little bit of a debate here, I feel, because I want to get this point in, because I think it might make for a funny conversation. The classic on the turn, the Bash at the Beach, the Heenan line of the "Whose side is he on?" I want to have this discussion, because I see this sometimes on message boards when the NWO is brought up, and the Hogan turn in particular, and one person around this table, at least one person, subscribes to this theory that this harmed the angle. Would you like to speak up and reveal yourself?
Yeah, it did.
Explain.
Let's move on.
No,
explain.
No, I think he's explained himself perfectly fine for an internet forum.
Okay, folks. The reason why I don't like this, because I saw this match on a VHS tape of WCW Best of Bash of the Beach. And
that must have been a short tape.
It was. But I must have watched this match, because I only had two tapes for WCW. I must have watched this match about 50 times at least. So I know it like the back of my hand. And the whole call, I'm always said I'm disappointed in Heenan when he did that, because I know he's better than that. I don't agree with anyone when they say that was the right thing to do. I thought it was a bad call by Heenan to turn around and say, oh, whose side is he on? Now, Liam, I'm sure, is going to claim that, you know, obviously I'm going to be biased because the fact of my opinion is retrospective. And so, obviously, looking back on it now, it probably was detrimental, but probably at the time you didn't expect it. Well, I can put it from both point of views. When I watched it retrospective, it ruined the angle for me because I didn't know this was when Hogan was going to turn. And so as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, well, this must be the match then. And also from being able to put my mindset at the time, if I was watching it as a, probably be about 12 at that point, if someone had said that, it doesn't matter if Hogan had never been a heel before, and there was no indication that he would ever turn heel. If I was listening to something, I wasn't an idiot when I was a kid. If someone had said, like, oh, whose side is he on? I may not immediately have thought he was turning heel, but I would instantly turn around and thought, well, why did he just say that for? And my issue with it, because the argument probably made by Liam, and I can see Carl itching forward towards Mike as well, is going to be made, is that, like, it didn't harm anything because, you know, it didn't harm the angle because no one thought Hogan was going to turn. My problem is if Hogan wasn't going to turn, and nobody thought, the audience didn't think Hogan was going to turn, so it wasn't going to be inevitability, why did Heenan think he was going to turn?
Okay, I don't want to sort of jump down your throat or anything like that. I will say this, if you would have thought that in the moment as a 12-year-old, God, you must have been a jaded child.
I thought I was jaded,
but Jesus Christ.
You have no fucking idea.
What I would say is, I wouldn't go as far as to say it helped the angle or anything like that. I'm not going to try and claim that. I'm not going to be that sort of cerebral. It helped it on this level because if you just look between the layers, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I'll get into that.
Don't get me wrong. But I don't think it harmed it. And the reason I don't think it harmed it was because it was Heenan that said it. And because it's Heenan that said it, if you look back at Bobby Heenan's history,
he always
doubted Hogan. He always said, you humanoids buy it, hook, line and sinker. You know, when he was a heel manager, he said, you can't trust Hogan. You know, whenever he was on commentary, look at Hogan raking the back, you know, clawing at the ice. He's cheating, Monsoon, he's cheating. Ventura used to do it before Heenan. He was, absolutely. But the point is, it was Heenan that said it. Mm. And Heenan, whenever he was a manager, whenever he was on commentary, he always questioned Hogan. So for Heenan to say it, it worked. It fitted. It made sense.
Just for me, it's just tricky because with Heenan, I don't think it killed the angle. You know, obviously it didn't kill the angle because it was a huge success afterwards. But my issue with it is okay, that's fair enough. So you're saying through the Heenan character, Heenan always had his doubts about Hogan. So I can understand that if that's like how he was going about it. But just as a general viewer of watching it, at no point did Nash or Hall insinuate that their third man was already employed by the WCW. They didn't mention at all any insinuations as to who the third man was. So probably some people may have thought it was someone in WCW. Maybe some people thought it was someone from WWF that was moving over. At no point did Heenan, the heel manager, if Heenan's the heel manager and he's, you know, stirring the shit pot, why didn't he turn around and say, how can we trust Sting? How can we trust Macho Man? What about Luger? Didn't Nash just protect Luger from the splash? Maybe Luger's actually all right and he's faking it and he's going to turn. At no point does he mention anyone else. And then as soon as Hogan comes out, instantly, he's like, oh, whose side is he on? Why did he not pick up on anyone else?
Well, because it's Hogan and not to sort of be plain about it, but it's Hogan and he never liked Hogan.
But he's had issues with everyone else as well.
But he was never that visceral about Sting or Luger. And he never had the history with Sting or Luger.
And he did accuse Dusty Rhodes at one point of being a third man as well, if I recall.
And the fact that it was Hogan that turned then facilitated not just Heenan, because Heenan had always doubted Hogan, but it facilitated the likes of Tanay, Zabisco, Shivani, whoever's on commentary, say, well, if Hogan's going to turn the archetypal good guy from the 80s, it could be anyone.
I will say, the thing is I completely agree. I think maybe we're even being a little specific with the Heenan Hogan thing, is because the amount of times Heenan would say something on any pay-per-view where you as an audience member would... Oh, shut the fuck up, Heenan. In, you know what I mean?
You'd be serious.
Yeah, you'd be serious, exactly. And so it would have been weird if Heenan had been quite... Now, I see your point. Imagine the whole same situation, however, with Michael Cole saying that line. You know what I mean? That's what I feel like G hears. You know, because if Michael Cole said that line, imagine that in your head, folks.
Yeah, and even if for example, it had been Shivani who'd said it, and your argument was, why did Shivani say it? I would more sort of go along the lines of what you're thinking then. If it was someone like that, yeah.
A lot of the people who say this, like you said, are watching this retroactively. They're not watching it for the first time. And as much as I know you can say that you want to, you know, you can put yourself in the time, there was a completely different time and place with the Hogan turn, and that's the reason why it did so big, because it was completely unique. The whose side is he online? It didn't affect anything negatively in the slightest. If the way you have to look at it for modern eyes, if John Cena was doing this angle with the Wyatts or something like that, where there was some kind of group and Cena comes down to save the day, and JBL said whose side is Cena on?
I was about to say it has to be JBL, isn't it?
Yeah, JBL says whose side is he on? Every single person, because Hogan was the baby, he was the babyface for the entire national expansion. It was inconceivable for him to turn heel. That was the whole point of why it worked so big as it did. If JBL said, whose side is John Cena on? Every single fan would say, fuck off, JBL. We know he's not turning heel. We know he's not turning heel. It's Cena. They're not going to turn him heel.
I actually don't think that's a good counterpoint.
It's the perfect counterpoint.
Because the thing, the difference between Cena and Hogan is whilst people might be jaded by the fact that they don't think the heel turn's happening, the fans are still expecting it and they still want it. So even if JBL turned around and said, whose side is he on? Whilst maybe none of us will believe it's happened, we kind of still hope it would. So if he turned around and said, whose side is he on? We probably, deep down inside, would be hoping, oh, maybe Cena's turning heel. But are they actually going to do it or not? That's completely different to Hogan.
That's the same principle. So Hogan was being booed by the crowds. That was the point. That's why I made that comparison, because the reaction is very similar. And that's why that whole thing of, okay, you can say, is it him? The heel commentator saying, is it him? Is he going to do this horrible act? Doesn't mean that everyone's going to suddenly... So, no, I don't think anybody, as someone who watched it at the time, will say, oh my God, it's definitely Hogan because he said that.
For me, it still slightly choreographs it for me, and it's still just like... It's still making you think about it. Even if at the time it didn't seem plausible or possible that Hogan was going to turn heel, it still made you think for a second. When he turns around, whose side is he on? It makes you doubt for a second. There were other things he could have said. He could have just simply said, why is he out here?
Would that have been any difference?
Because that could insinuate, like, yeah, why is Hogan out here? Because that was the weird thing.
They're going to do one or two things. He's going to join them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the exact same thing as what he did. The perception of why he was coming out was because Luger was down. He was making up the third man spot for the good guys, and as it turned out, he wasn't.
But that's another thing that's weird with the match, because, like, yeah, okay, so the outsiders had a third man, but obviously that person wasn't at ringside. So they do this whole thing when Luger gets taken out, and then they act as if Sting and Macho Man are like on the downturn. They're like they're outnumbered, but they're not. It's 2-on-2.
But I thought the match is absolutely fair
at that point.
Yeah, but that's to me, that's what's great about it.
That's what works.
You got the babyface announcer and the heel announcer both complaining about how unfair it is, because these heels are just decimating the babyface. Mm. The way the angle should be booked.
Yeah, at that point, that whole thing of the reason why the NWO works is because they put so much heat on this, is these guys are dangerous, they're really good, they're a massive threat. They were complaining about, why aren't they bringing out the third guy right now when it's 3-on-2?
If that match just descends into a typical, for lack of a better word, tag team match with a bit of give and take, well, where's the threat? This is just a tag match,
I can see, obviously, you know, the fact that they put those two over as being a big threat is absolutely excellent. But, like, you know, to insinuate that they needed a third man to put up against them when it's Sting and Macho Man, it's just, I don't know. It just doesn't sit right with me. I know it's just my opinion, but it's just like when I watch it back, and yes, it is from a retrospective opinion, and yes, I can look at it through eyes of at the time.
You can't.
I can't say what I can.
No, you weren't there, man!
Honestly, that's the thing. That's one of those things that I will disagree with you to the end of time. Unless you are in the moment and you actually are seeing it through the eyes of the time, you can always look through retrospectively. I understand your point. But you can't put yourself in the exact same time, especially if you know what was coming. You knew Hogan turned heel in the end.
Yeah.
So when you watched it,
I didn't know when it was happening. I didn't know when it was going to happen.
And that's fine.
But if you knew at the time, you wouldn't even know it was going
to
happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why I think that line to me doesn't stand out as much as it does to you. But it's just different perspectives, and I think that's what it comes down to. Mm. Moving along, Lust Hogan from Pro Wrestling Only. Hi to Terry Tyrell and Jane back in Minnesota. The positives did not outweigh the negatives, in my opinion. The NWO certainly helped freshen WCW up and push them to number one, but there was never a payoff for the angle because the NWO was never vulnerable, going back to what we said about that Bash at the Beach match. Guys, refusing to put over other talent in a logical manner, Starrcade 97 among others, didn't help either. It just seemed the NWO would never die, and when it became stale, the group looked like a bunch of old guys trying to hang on to a gimmick that made them cool, when in fact it did just the opposite. The length of time the NWO went is obviously a key discussion point here, because in terms of the negatives of the NWO, the length and the lack of a real end to the NWO angle is a lot of what harmed WCW. The pieces just kind of fell apart.
I mean, we've talked about briefly about NWO as the threat that it was in the initial stage, and I think it got until, was it Starrcade 96, Luger beats the Giant. That's the first sort of big win that WCW has over the NWO. Imagine that for 6 months. Yeah. WCW's basically been getting its asses kicked by the NWO. It takes 6 months for them to finally get one up on the card. I think Piper beats Hogan at Starrcade, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's another big one.
In the match in which the babyface signed the contract where
the title was on the line.
Yeah.
What the fuck, Piper?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, God. But just think, they played it out for what I would consider a good length of time, where they were a threat, they were on top. And then you sort of fast forward, and by the time you get through to Starrcade 97, you sort of sat and thought, Jesus Christ, these guys have been getting beat down for 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, you had Luger win the belt for a cup of coffee, and you get one or two moments.
But, DDP got a moment where he beat Randy Savage, and he was elevated through this whole process.
Excellent work by Savage, a real selfless act that I give him tremendous credit for. But by and large, I think we'd all agree they've been getting their asses kicked.
Yeah.
And then you get to Starrcade 97, and the great build where you mentioned before about them not blowing their load.
Yep.
That's Sting and Hogan. They didn't blow their load.
The biggest buy rate in the history of the company as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest buy rate in the history of the company. And you get to Starrcade 97, and that should have been the revenge show. That should have been the show where WCW comes out all guns blazing and just decimates them. Sting's back. Sting's the champ. We just massacre them. And then if you want to, you can even play out the bit of infight and they disintegrate.
I think that's the way you do it.
That's the way it should be, you know. And it ends with Hogan and Hall, Hogan and Nash, rather. But yeah, you don't get that payoff. I think Bagwell is a second-rate NWO member, gets a win on the show, and then, you know, everyone knows about the main event and what happened there. I don't need to go into detail.
The fact that Kevin Nash was supposed to job to the Giant and then backed out, claiming a heart attack, by the way, is one of the more comical moments.
Not the first time. He has a lot of heart attacks.
Right around the time he's supposed to do a job, I've noticed.
Yeah, a lot of heart
attacks. That's funny.
I really like that guy.
He's alive.
Yeah, that man's had a real rotten run of luck just before pay-per-views.
Just like that. One thing, actually, that came to mind when I thought about this a while ago, was that the NWO, the thing with wrestling companies is if something's working, they tend to stick to it as long as they feasibly can.
That's the nail on the head point right there. Absolutely.
But here's the thing, is you know, usually a lot of times in wrestling companies, factions tend to break up only because, oh god, two of the main guys are injured, we're kind of screwed. But the NWO bloated in such a way as you could have people injured, but there were still so many of them that it wasn't going to fade. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that was a victim of its own bloat.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because that was one of the points I brought up earlier before we started the show, was, you know, about the actual duration of the NWO and whether it actually, you know, it should have been finished a lot sooner. And yeah, like, you're absolutely right. That's, you actually absolutely hit the nail on the head.
Thank you.
You know, the angle probably should have ended at Starrcade 97. That's at least my opinion. But like, obviously, when you got something that's so good, that's finally putting WCW on top, there was no way in hell they were ever going to stop that angle. They were going to ride it until it was dead. And to be honest, from a business point of view, I actually don't blame him for that. Because, you know, that's what you got to do to try and stay on top. But for talking about what Carl was mentioning about like that initial period, I think they missed a trick in 97. And Carl was absolutely right. They were drumming WCW for ages. And it was because they were waiting for Sting. They were waiting to cash in on that moment with Sting where he beats Hogan at Starrcade 97. And for me, one of the main things that one of the drop balls that they did with this NWO angle was the Four Horsemen. And basically how, like, surely when you have one group coming in as hot as the NWO, and you've already got, from your history, your legacy, an already established group in the Four Horsemen, they never really capitalized on that potential feud. And for me, that was what they missed out in 97. Before Sting comes along and finally puts the nail in the coffin, they could have used the Four Horsemen versus NWO angle as the main storyline.
I can totally see that in a retrospective way, but the amount of new fans WCW got during that period because of the NWO, and this is pre-widespread internet,
yeah,
it's a lot of effort to get explained the history behind WCW and the Horsemen at that point, in my opinion.
On a national basis.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing we do today, because we brought the NWO back into WWF because everyone knew who the NWO was, because they were either fans at the time or they had the internet. And at the time, a lot of those people wouldn't have been fans at the time to know the Horsemen from any other new made-up faction, and they wouldn't have any internet to research it. So I see your point, but I'm not sure it works in that time period.
It's interesting, because the Arn Anderson retirement speech that led to the great, you know, the great My Spot speech and the subsequent NWO parody that's making Carl wince right now. that to me is the kind of the ideal time. If they were going to do that, it would have been then. And I always hate that Kurt Hennig heel turn at War Games, where it looked like, okay, you know what, we can do the Horsemen NWO here, and they just made it just another NWO swerve.
One of the worst fucking things.
Honest
I
to
hate
God, his veins are coming out of his forehead.
The worst fucking thing I hated about that whole end of it was exactly that moment when Arn Anderson, dad, bless his heart, decides to retire, right, and he decides to offer his spot to Kurt Hennig, right, and Kurt Hennig was absolutely the right person to take that role, okay? A hard spot it would be to replace, because Arn Anderson was the great, you know, right-hand man for Ric Flair. But because, obviously, Kurt Hennig had such history with Ric Flair, it just made so much sense that this guy could fit into the Four Horsemen, not only that, but be a pivotal role with Ric Flair. And so when he took his spot, when watching that back, I thought, oh, wow, that's great. And he goes, oh, God, I can't wait to watch some more stuff of Hennig in the Four Horsemen. And then, like, lo and behold, they couldn't hold themselves, could they? They just couldn't leave it alone. No, instantly Hennig turns heel and joins NWO.
And the Horsemen are right back where they were.
Yeah, right back where they are. And he said, you bastards,
it's the invasion
you could
angle.
Have had...
whole same spot.
Yeah, you could have had such a great thing there with Kurt Hennig as Ric Flair's right-hand man. It would have made so much sense.
And I think that the reason that, to me, Hennig was never a fit for the NWO under any circumstances, because to me he was a guy, he epitomised tradition, and that was always the undertone to the feud. WCW would be the
tradition bites, the tradition bites banners they would put up all the time, and the flyers from the top of the building.
Yeah, and it was just, to me, when I think Hennig, I think obviously his dad, Larry the Axe, I think AWA, all that entails. This was a, you know, guy trained along with by Vern Gagne, among others, and that sort of thing. And I just thought, this is a tradition guy in the NWO, a group which has Nash and Hall, who've always had that sort of cool cocky edge to him. Six, you know, Sean Waltman, X-Pac, whatever name you want to give him, who's always been sort of, they had that punk upstart attitude. And that was always sort of the undertone with NWO. So to me, Hennig never really fit.
Well, there's a bunch of guys who didn't really fit. Yeah. We can get to them later.
Yeah. And that speaks more to Luke's bloated remarks.
No, they did do little bits and pieces where WCW would get one up. You know, Lex Luger beat Hulk Hogan for the WCW title in an episode of Nitro, which was a great moment. Diamond Dallas Page, mentioned earlier on, gets over on Randy Savage. Flair, Piper, and Kevin Green go against the Wolfpack and win that match. Yeah. There were little traces of hope for WCW, but they were few and far between, and the NWO dominated the TV. Bad News Gertner from TPWW Forum says, WCW would have never reached its heights if it weren't for the NWO. The NWO is not what killed WCW. How it was handled did. It was an amazing angle. Stumpers PC from Pro Wrestling Only says, the NWO was a victim of its own success. The original NWO concept and angle was a huge success, both creatively and financially. The first 6 months where they continually build heat on the NWO are really well done and one of the better executed successful long-term angles and national promotion has ever carried out. Even 1997 had plenty of positives, and while the NWO had already outlived its usefulness by the end of the year, Starrcade's buy rate would suggest that there was nothing wrong with drawing it out until then. The problem was that those in charge viewed the NWO as the sole reason for their success, and brashly felt like it could keep going forever. Every angle has its expiration date. The NWO angle in particular was always going to be difficult to maintain, even if they had booked it differently from 1997 to 1999. The NWO worked so well initially because the group was booked ultra strong, and Sullivan, as the booker, built a lot of heat on them. You can only put heat on the heels for so long before you start seeing diminishing returns. The fans want a conclusion at some point and want the faces to get their revenge. Everyone saw that the NWO got over by being put over so strongly initially and foolishly decided they could maintain that momentum by continuing to have them one-up WCW. Wrestling doesn't work that way. At some point, there needs to be a payoff.
I mean, yeah, they did everything they could to try and keep that angle going for as long as possible. You know, they did the whole thing, you know, they split the group up into two different factions, Hollywood and Wolfpack. They did absolutely everything. Then, you know, they put them back together again.
I hated that.
All of it was bad. To that point, right, kind of after Starrcade, and Carl alluded to, Starrcade itself was a problem, but everything after it for me is just diminishing. It's on a downward spiral from there.
But that's guaranteed to happen in all forms of media. I mean, it's actually very much a thing of the times. I mean, you think of popular TV shows even then. They had no end goal in mind. These days we're used to TV, to continue as an example, TV shows these days generally get to set their own final season now, and they know they want to go out on a high because they don't want to be like The X-Files, which was very much of that period, which just trailed off into pointlessness.
Yeah, now you get Breaking Bad where they say how many seasons they're going to have ahead of time and you know what's coming.
Exactly. And wrestling has learned from that, and wrestling tends to do. It will learn from popular media. And nowadays we do have more of a willingness to break up things that work, possibly too willing in the case of, say, The Shield. There is a case of it being possibly too willing to do that nowadays. But it's not. Let's not just say that it's WCW pushing the NWO, because, you know, if Vince had the NWO, he would have ridden it to hell. You know, wrestling, they want to keep it going no matter what, and I feel it's slightly unfair to stress too strongly that it's WCW and the NWO are the example of this. Everything in wrestling at the time was the example.
And I will say that the context of time and place with the Monday Night War, where, and we mentioned this before actually in the Overrated, I think, where I think it was you, Carl, that said Bret Hart, who has, and Mick Foley, who have the opinion that the WWF in 1997 was actually a better product than WCW was, and you believe that they're absolutely correct in that regard. The WWF was actually picking up a bit of momentum, so maybe you can't really blame them for thinking, you know what, should we stick with the thing that brought us to the dance?
Because what else have we got?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. They did have things. They just signed Bret Hart. They had Sting as the top guy. Well, Goldberg was getting some serious momentum. There were options.
Well, the weird thing is I can kind of think I'm almost opposite to that, is because when I come watching this stuff back and obviously looking at the business sense of why they kept the NWO going for so long, it almost comes across that the reason why the NWO lasted for so long was because they were scared of it ending. Because I think, like, once they'd done the NWO angle, I think they were scared that they didn't know how to follow it up, and I think that was the problem, because they just got ahead of WWF and they thought, God, if we end this now, how the fuck do we top this? And I think they were scared.
Well, Bischoff, I think it has said himself on a number of occasions that when you're getting into 98, he's really burnt out in truth. He's still on TV, but his mind's completely frazzled. His memory's hazy of a lot of the stuff because he was so burnt out. I think he said he just wanted to go to Wyoming and go fly fishing for 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, but it's...
Or the Gold Club.
Wink. but I think it's a case of creative didn't really know where to go after the NWO ended, as you said. But to Liam's point, there were things there, and it's one of those looking back retrospectively sort of deals, I admit, and I don't want to get too far down the fantasy booking trail, but you had Bret Hart in, you know, I think it was Meltzer who said, has WWF just handed WCW the keys to Canada? And what happens? They run one Nitro in March of 99 after the bloom is well and truly off the Bret Hart rose. But, you know, Bret's there. You've got Flair's still there. He's not having his legal troubles at that point with Bischoff. Not yet. So, you know, you've got that natural. You can go Bret Flair. You can go Bret Hogan,
and these that aren't was the obvious
and, these, one. And these aren't ones that you need to do, in, you know, one and done. You could have had it play out. Hogan's been beaten by Sting, the NWO's falling around him. What does he need? He needs that catalyst, and Bret Hart could have been it.
Another thing I'll note as well is not just a change of, oh, we don't want to lose the NWO because what will we do without them? The NWO represents the peak faction. I mean, you think back to factions. The NWO is a faction. And you remove the NWO, you can't create another faction now because they're just going to be compared to the NWO until you had a cool down period. That changes the landscape of WCW so heavily. I mean, you think back to like War Games and stuff. A lot of the stuff you remember from WCW, a large team versus large team. And you take away the NWO and you look to yourself that, okay, we can't build another big evil faction anytime soon because all it's going to be is NWO Light no matter what we do. It becomes a very different place if you take away the NWO entirely. And you can't get away from that cooldown period. It's an interesting one, and it's a bit more of a problem for them, in my opinion, than perhaps we realise.
If I can just jump in there quickly, to your point about cooldown period, and I think that's an interesting point worth mentioning. The time frame in which they were in at that point, you got the Monday Night Wars, and then, you know, both companies, WWF was a bit more forward thinking in their planning, you know, don't get me wrong. But in a lot of respects, both companies are living week to week.
Yeah.
It's the hot shot in the era.
You're right.
And they, whilst any other time, logically, you would think, okay, there's going to be a little bit of a tapering off before we go gangbusters again. In the heat of a ratings war. And wrestling was the big thing. You'd be terrified of calling off and, God, we're the cool thing, and now we're fading into obscurity as the WWF marches away and steals our thunder. There'd have been absolute panic there for a cool down period.
And unfortunately, what they did create a natural cool down period by not going with the next thing.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the main thing that the problem with trying to follow the NWO is I'm actually going to say that NWO wasn't a faction. It wasn't a faction. It wasn't a stable. It was actually a brand. And that's the problem because, you know, they were trying to put NWO as a full brand. It wasn't like the Four Horsemen where they released a t-shirt. They released numerous t-shirts. There's numerous merchandise in there you could buy for it. They even at one point obviously tried to make NWO its actual own brand as like it was going to be like its own company.
The horrible NWO pay-per-view sold out, which is atrocious.
To your point, G, that was Bischoff's initial idea.
Yeah.
He didn't want a natural end to a storyline.
Yeah.
He wanted a separate NWO,
growth.
a separate entity, yeah. Like
it, that, but it, create it, his yeah. own competition. Yeah.
But yeah, at it, the end of the day, whether or not Bischoff saw it as the faction, the fans did. The paying audience still saw it in those traditional wrestling terms.
All right, so moving along, Smack 2K from Pro Wrestling Only. In regards to whether or not the positives outweigh the negatives, NWO equals Attitude Era. Without the first, we don't have the second. The NWO was amazing from July to December 1996 in terms of what was happening, but after that, things started to slide, although it almost took 2 years for it to finally fall fast in 1999. They never blew off the NWO or ended the angle, and they had chances to, or even times when WCW would win something and force the NWO to take a back seat and regroup for a while in 1997. Starrcade 1997 should have been Sting winning decisively. It causes the NWO to splinter after Hogan loses again at Super Bowl after botched interference from Savage. Then you have Sting as champion, he can take on all challengers in and out of the NWO. You also have two NWOs to feud for months to lead to War Games 98. Blow off, but the NWO is either on the same level or a step below Sting in the title. The NWO was great, and without it, who knows what we'd think of 1997-2001 in wrestling, and who knows if the WWF would have continued its 95 to early 96 ways. The NWO was the catalyst for all the greatness in wrestling that followed, and all the nostalgia that people call back to today. It, directly and indirectly, led to huge ratings and wrestling becoming mainstream. It caused wrestling to become cool to young adults, and I was at Penn State from 96 to 2000 and saw it firsthand. So the positives way outweigh the negatives, as the NWO is one of the top 5 most important US wrestling angles that ever take place. Side note, I'm a huge NWO mark, but if Bret and Jarrett don't get hurt, NWO 2000 could have been great. Just saying.
First off, fuck Jarrett. But yeah, I mean, when you look at NWO, I mean, it's kind of obvious that the positive effect that NWO had, particularly on factions alone, is just like, ever since the NWO, everything is trying to replicate it. I mean, it did encourage WWF to do the DX angle, which was basically that they're trying to do their version of NWO. And ever since then, whether it's Evolution or Shield or whatever, there's always some sort of aspect that they're trying to take away from NWO.
But I think a lot of ECW fans are probably suicidal at the notion that the NWO created the Attitude Era. We know what their mantra is.
Yeah, indeed.
But I think there's a lot of points. But I think there's a lot of credence in that email there, particularly with the sort of the civil war between the NWO.
I don't hate that idea. Actually.
I don't hate that idea at all. I think that should have been the way to go. In retrospect, you know, word of the podcast. But it's funny that during that time period in 1980, I think they also had a second out for ending the NWO. You didn't do it with Sting. I personally agree with him. I think that was the mistake. Sting crushes the NWO, sort of the...
Yeah, Starrkey 97 was such a disappointment. I mean, we kind of brushed over Starrkey 97 as the big failure, what a failure.
As the threat to WCW, that's where it should have ended then. Mm. They're no longer the threat to WCW. They're warring amongst themselves. But in 90, I think you had that second out with Goldberg.
Yeah, they totally
Goldberg
did, yeah.
Could have been the man to finally completely obliterate. And just imagine, you know, Spear Jackhammer, mowing them down.
Yeah.
And Goldberg's made for life.
Yeah, there was absolutely, yeah, the two ways out they had. As I said, the Starrkade, obviously, Starrkade 97 was a problem, and that match just went right down the wrong way. It should have basically been what we've seen recently with John Cena and Brock Lesnar. Sting should have just gone in there and mowed through Hogan. And that would have worked really well because, you know, Sting was, you know, the backbone of WCW. You know, he was one of their main guys. But as Carl alluded to, like, it's the Goldberg was actually, could have potentially been a great angle if he literally took each member out one at a time, as in they're gone. As soon as he spears and jackhammers them, they're gone.
And so, with Hogan.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, and just leaving Hogan. Hogan would have sold that, you know, if he wanted to, really well, you know.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah, he would have sold it really well, where just like all his boys are gone, and he's on his own, and he's facing this monster that's about to kill him. It would have been a great moment, because everyone would have known what was going to happen, and whilst I'm sure they would have been tempted to swerve him, they shouldn't have. They should have just had Goldberg just destroy him, and it would have been a great story, but obviously, because it was a great story, they didn't do it.
PT from Pro Wrestling Only. I've seen a lot of references to every angle having an expiration date and how the NWO greatly lived its expiration date. When do you guys feel the angle should have ended? Boy, I really should have asked that. Really should have read that one earlier. Huh?
Well, editing.
Yeah. See 97 Starrkade pay per view.
All right. I was just about to turn 9 when the 96 bash occurred, so I was a mark during pretty much the NWO's entire run. I've also rewatched a lot of Nitros from that era via Classics on Demand, so I've seen the entire thing through different lenses. As early as the fall of 96, you can see the NWO transitioning from group of outside invaders to dominant heel stable. It was still successful. 1997 Starrkade proved that, but the transition happened fairly early into the run. I grew up in New York, so I was a huge WWF fan. I was also a huge Hogan fan, man after your heart here, Carl. And I followed him when he went to WCW, but it wasn't until Nitro launched that I really started to prefer WCW to the WWF. What rewatching the 97 Nitros taught me was that the fall of 97 was a pretty bad period for WCW, even if it was commercially successful. While it was really great for the WWF, even if their business was yet to boom, it really felt as though they were treading water from Road Wild until Starrkade, and it was at this point that the NWO's constant winning started to be way too much. It almost felt like there was no point in watching until Sting and Hogan. The Nitro after Fall Brawl 97 was one of the most depressing episodes of wrestling TV I've ever watched. Kurt Hennig beating Mongo in the main event for the US title was the poor icing on the cake.
Yeah?
It was horrendous. For anyone with a more critical eye than mine at the time, they would have already been switching to the WWF, and it would all get so much worse.
That man is an absolute godsend. Email in any time you want, any time of day. I completely agree. I often echo the Vince remarks when he talked about it. When he's thinking, what do the audience want? How can they be watching this crap?
Yeah.
If anyone wants to look back, and I'm sure plenty of people have got the tapes out there, you can all go back and view it. And kudos to him for watching it legally through Classics on Demand. But
because you would never do anything below, under the table, Carl.
Absolutely not. I'm a jam-up guy.
But just like Hypnosis.
Absolutely. But no, I think critically, if you want to go sort of the critically acclaimed route, what WWF is putting on when they're crisscrossing between America and Canada is so much better to watch back now. It holds up so much better. One more quick point when he's talking about the fall of 97. I'm not sure how many of us around the table remember this. They had Sting wrestle on Nitro before Starrkade.
Oh.
He wrestled Savage in a singles match.
Really?
And Savage... Well, Savage didn't go over, but do you know how it ended? Savage was pinning Sting and Hogan broke up the pin.
Oh, God. Well, that made sense. Damn.
I mean, yeah. Okay.
How's that for the fall of 97? And that is why that man is absolutely 100% on the money.
I mean, what you just said there, that fucking makes absolutely no sense. Though, actually, you know, putting Sting on right before Starrcade, that actually doesn't surprise me. Because
terrible.
Absolutely disastrous. But, like, I can absolutely understand why they did it, because it's just like, you know, at that time period, they were trying to win every ratings that they could, and having Sting come back for his first match ever was more ratings for them, I guess, because they were still going to get the buy rate for Starrcade, because it was still Sting versus Hogan, so they just thought, hey, let's try and make some extra ratings.
It's horrific from a story standpoint, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I can see why they did it, but the actual result, what you're saying, that Hogan breaks up the pin, that makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
Just to finish off PT's comments, with all that said, to answer the original question, I think the positives outweighed the negatives. Wrestling needed a change. It needed a kick in the ass. The NWO ushered in the change it needed. Sure, it may have killed the company, but WCW may have died anyway, or at least shrank to a really small level, possibly taking the WWF along for the ride. Dylan Waco's got a bit of a contrasting point here. The only way the negatives outweigh the positives is if you believe that the NWO angle is a large part of what killed WCW. I don't believe that. I believe the death of WCW was inevitable, because it's a horribly mismanaged company from the jump. If the NWO never happens, but the company is still held hostage by bad contracts, TV is run so chaotically, so many people are in charge that no one knows who is in charge, then WCW still goes out of business. In fact, without the NWO, and especially without Hogan, it is very easy to envision a scenario where WCW goes out of business years before it actually did. From an artistic standpoint, you can argue that the NWO had more negatives than positives, and I could probably be convinced of it, but looking purely at business, I think it's a very hard argument to make.
I mean, at the same time, the three people that helped save WCW for a brief time were also three of the biggest problems that they had after the NWO angle was finished. It was all the politicking by, in particular, Hogan and Nash, which was what was, you know, ruining WCW.
That's all very, very true, but when you look at it, that's not really the fault of a storyline or the faction. That's a couple of, you know, bad apples in the barrel.
Yeah. The point that Dylan makes about the inherent problems with the company of the bad contracts and stuff like that. Someone you want to jump on there, Carl?
No, it was just sort of to echo the points, because I think Dylan makes quite a sage argument in truth, and I think, you know, it's not the NWO angle that pays Dennis Rodman $1 million in 99 for three dates.
Or Jay Leno.
It's not the NWO angle that has Jay Leno putting Hogan in a wrist lock. It's not the NWO angle that has DJ Ram. Everyone remember him? Everyone remember DJ Ram?
He didn't kill the WCW, Carl, come on.
He didn't kill the company, but it wasn't good for TV, was it? And it wasn't the NWO angle that paid Master P $1 million and his, what were they called again?
The No Limit Soldiers.
Yeah, I mean, you just mentioned a lot of celebrity names that obviously did a lot of damage.
Using that term very loosely.
But names that were paid a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, but in fairness, of those, you know, the Dennis Rodmans, the Karl Malones, and the Jay Lenos, which one was worse, those three put together or David Arquette?
Oh, Arquette was far worse.
Oh, yeah.
Arquette did far more damage.
Yeah.
Because...
And that was post-NWO.
Rodman and Malone did do a big pay-per-view. They did a huge pay-per-view for the tag match they did. David Arquette did one of the worst pay-per-views they ever did, and the WCW title never drew again after that.
Yeah.
Rick Morris from the FDH Lounge, the legendary Rick Morris. I do feel that the positives vastly outweigh the negatives, because the NWO was one of the key cornerstones of the greatest wrestling era we've ever seen, and sadly, likely the best we will ever see. Yes, it was never really blown off, which was jarring, and yes, it was allowed to be bigger than the portrayal of WCW, which is very problematic, but you can't separate most of the NWO's flaws from the general business and booking situation of WCW, which would have plagued any great angle or faction, again going back to Dylan's point there. For example, Hulk Hogan's stupid creative control clause predated the NWO era as we know. The NWO spurred on the WWF to steal ECW's mojo. There we go. And start bringing that extreme excitement to a bigger stage. So it gets credit for improving the entire landscape creatively, even as it handed the WWF the brass knuckles it would use to finish WCW off. Plus, I look at it this way. Consider the crappy booking for most of Hogan's pre-NWO years in WCW. The Yeti, anyone? I think that we were looking at more of the same unless an invasion storyline was going to shake up the figurative snow globe, and to the benefit of the entire industry for those few glorious years, that's exactly what they did.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why Rick Morris is one of the greatest men in Western civilization.
Gary Thompson! The positives outweigh the negatives because it gave wrestling the kick in the backside it needed. It was coming out of the cartoon era but needed a push over the edge. Hogan turning also helped, and we'll never really see that again. Maybe just a bastardized version over the years. Craig Atkinson, the negatives outweigh the positives here, getting the flip side. Obviously, the few initial weeks of the feud were great moments. However, once Vincent appeared, the NWO was blatantly no longer the top guys. There were good moments after this, lots of them, especially with the Sting storyline and Goldberg vs. Hogan, but the Wolfpack vs. Hollywood storyline was weak. The finger poke of doom! The NWO B-team! The repeated rehashes. Once the NWO started adding everyone under the sun to their roster, it became a liability. Ultimately, the company's reliance on this angle and continual return to it was a major factor in the creative slump that contributed to WCW's downfall. Now, I do think that this is the perfect time to do what we were actually looking to do here. G. John Chase, if you want to take the reins a little bit, of looking at everybody that was included in the New World Order and who really had any business being involved in the biggest angle in the history of WCW.
Yeah, I think probably the one aspect that probably most people remember about the NWO is actually its membership.
Indeed.
Basically, and just I think that's the biggest problem that most people have with it, and it's one of the big negatives, was that it seemed the NWO would hire anybody.
Pretty much.
That they want. Okay, so this was in the original NWO before they decided to split in two.
Okay.
Okay. Scott Hall.
Of course.
Kevin Nash.
Yeah. Yep.
And Hogan.
Obviously.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. The financer of NWO, Ted DiBiase.
I like that.
Yeah, the idea was solid.
Yeah.
It was good logic.
Logic.
It was a
solid
idea until they put Eric Bischoff in it.
And then he pretty much took his place.
Yeah, pretty much took his place. Yeah. Referee Nick Patrick.
I didn't hate the Nick Patrick element to it. I didn't love
with
it.
The earring?
That fucking terrible earring. Yeah, fucking hell. And the neck brace.
Brilliant.
I didn't hate it. I didn't love it either.
I didn't hate the idea of the heel referee, but let's be absolutely clear about this. I hate Nick Patrick.
Yeah. Okay. I could do without watching him sell.
I'm almost kind of
ever.
The other way on that, in that it's like Nick Patrick's going to be remembered as probably the best heel referee ever, but what does that really fucking say?
He's no Danny Davis.
The Giant.
Giant was kind of a reactionary thing. They wanted Waltman as the fourth member of the NWO, and the WWF were trying to. They were being
four
funny.
Just didn't work as a name. That was the problem.
Yeah, I know. The thing with the Giant, that they put the Giant in there because they were trying to get Waltman for Hog Wild. WWF fired him, but then they were being tricky with the termination notice. They pretty much were holding him off every week so he couldn't debut, and they kind of had laid the groundwork that a fourth member was coming. They tried to get Davey Boy as well for the fourth man, if I'm not mistaken. The Giant never really seemed to fit. I thought he was a bad call, and I think the fact that they ixnayed him from the group 6 months later was pretty much symbolic of that.
I think they just wanted that. I just think they wanted a big guy in the group, because I think probably from their way of thinking it was going to be
Nash.
I know they had Nash.
They had Nash,
but it might have been like a bit of a I don't know.
Get maybe, the Yeti.
He was
that's the correct pronunciation.
Maybe he was hibernating at the time.
I'll play devil's advocate here. Maybe they thought that it might not be believable that at the time the faction that was only like three or four people at a time could beat down someone the size of the Giant. So maybe they were just thinking, like, oh, how's that going to come across realistic? So let's just turn the Giant heel.
But that was why it never really sat well with me, because they'd already had Hogan beaten for the belt recently.
And they had him three
straight away, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they immediately turned him heel right after that, which didn't really fit.
With that, we move on to fake Sting. That whole angle.
As a mechanism to actually turn Sting, I thought that was actually good, pretty well done. Like I said... The actual initial angle caused like quarter of the viewing audience to turn over, so
hindsight.
Yeah, but at the same time, it did work as a long-term narrative for Sting. It worked because the buy rate speaks for itself.
It was just poorly executed, in a way. You know what I mean? It's a tricky one to execute. Don't get me wrong. The idea is
a little bit hokey. Yeah.
I mean, no one was clamoring for the debut of Jeff Farmer in WCW. Don't get me wrong. No. But
being the world's biggest Jeff Farmer, Mark, was that his name, Jeff Farmer?
Yeah.
but no, like Liam says, it was a perfect mechanism for what they were trying to achieve.
Six, Vincent, Miss Elizabeth, Eric Bischoff.
Six, yes. For sure, I think.
Yeah, you remember him as part of the NWO.
He had a very underrated role in the group as the rat chicken shit heel. He was hanging out with the big powerful gang. I thought there was a lot of heat on Six. There's a lot more they could have done. Who were some of the other ones you mentioned there? Miss Elizabeth. Yep, I was never Miss really.
That was weird.
Yep. Vincent.
Yeah, that was, Vincent was so uncoordinated he couldn't catch a disease in a whorehouse.
I wasn't a big fan of Vincent. I thought he had absolutely nothing.
I wasn't a big fan of Vincent. I wasn't a big fan of Shane. I wasn't a big fan of Virgil. Pat Patterson was, but that's another story.
It was another story.
Yeah, it was just that whole thing because he was obviously connected to Ted DiBiase. He was another WWF guy, wasn't it?
It was just that, it was like symbolism. His whole career was one big rib. I didn't understand it.
Here we go. This next one you all love. Buff Bagwell.
No place.
Anywhere.
Not even porn.
See, disease, whorehouse, and Missy Hyatt.
It all comes together.
There we go. Michael Wall Street.
Absolutely no business.
I've forgotten about Michael. Fuck. Oh, wow.
No business. No,
terrible.
Big Bubba Rogers.
No.
I love the boss.
I was about to say, you ain't going to get any boss man hate over here, but no.
Scott Norton?
No.
No.
Randy Savage?
I would argue no.
Really?
I'd
say yes.
I thought that he was... heel Randy Savage. It's one of those things where, artistically speaking, it did work out, but the whole thing of Savage was the guy that they turned on to begin with, that Hogan leg dropped.
Yeah. It doesn't... You can't make sense of it if you actually have memory.
They tried, they tried to make sense of it by using Liz as the bait to try to bring him over. But even then, it's just like, it's one of those things where retroactively you can look at it and be like, that was just like a cheap excuse to put him in
wrestlers,
there.
It's the wrestling fans' memory thing.
And the romantic in me kind of likes the idea of the wild man Randy Savage as a sort of the renegade fighting NWO.
Quickly throw three names out there because they had a Japanese contingent of the Great Muta, Tenzan, and
Masa Chono.
And Chono.
Not novel idea. Added absolutely nothing from an American perspective.
It meant nothing.
Dennis Rodman. I think we've already said enough about him already.
You know what? No, I thought he had, as the wacky celebrity, he had a reputation at the time. He was a big deal. He was someone who actually meant something.
And he still means a lot in wrestling.
Oh. Well, not really, but but I think as the novelty guy that's around every so often, that he had that renegade thing to him. I didn't hate Rodman in it. Kind of tied back to the Hollywood Hogan thing of him rubbing shoulders with celebrities.
Yeah. It was of its time. Exactly. And it will never look good now in retrospect. No. You know what I mean?
Rick Rude, Louis Piccoli, Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty, absolutely not.
Don't make any sense, does it?
When you think New World Order, you think Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah, Dusty Rhodes and Rick Rude doesn't sit well with me, because going back to the Kurt Enning remarks I made earlier, those to me are tradition guys. They would be the antithesis of the NWO.
Yeah, Rick Rude... you had a lot of non-wrestling members. Rude added nothing at all to the NWO.
It was just a chance to give a black eye to Vince by having him appear on Nitro.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was a pot shot.
Spicoli, it was very brief, his tenure in the NWO, who knows what would have happened. Yeah. I guess ultimately you'd probably say no just because of what ended up happening.
Conan.
I didn't hate Conan in the NWO.
I'm probably going to upset a lot of people because they'll probably tell me how great he was in Mexico before he came to North America and how good he was in LAX. And he was good in LAX as a mouthpiece. Don't get me wrong, I thought he was excellent in that role. In WCW, I really thought he was the shits.
Yeah!
No one remembers that great US title run, Conan.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
I will say, I mean, as much as we were just talking about people who did not because the traditionalists fit the NWO mold, I kind of see Conan fitting the NWO
mold. That's why. Because the things, I don't like, for the elitist perspective, if you're going to keep the NWO as a heel stable of about 8 or 9 guys, he probably doesn't fit in that sense.
Yeah, but there were better choices.
There were better choices than Conan. But at the same time, Conan was a good fit for the Wolfpack. I think he was over as a babyface during that period of time.
He was, and I'll never understand why.
I'm not saying that he was the best worker in the world.
That's a fair point.
But I do think what you're saying, for that babyface section, because as a heel, he added nothing to the NWO, so he was a waste of space there. Luke?
Don't go forgetting your demographics, people. You got mostly middle-aged white guys in this. Let's bring in that Conan fella.
And Conan actually, compared to some of the other guys in the NWO, actually came off like he was pretty cool compared to others.
Brian Adams?
Fuck off. Never liked him.
Yeah, I want to jump in and say I never liked that guy.
The Disciple.
Well, here's the thing about the Wow, three death stares. You know what? There's a point where I can't even make a joke. Never mind.
The joke is the disciple. Big Papa Pump, Big Booty Daddy, Scott Steiner. Now, come on. That's a yes. That's a tick in that box. Come on. Big Papa Pump. Come on.
Oh, I'm not
Come on.
This. I love heel Scott Steiner. I do. And I think heel Scott Steiner was much better. The Steiner brothers as a babyface team was played out, so I don't hate the idea of Steiner doing his thing earlier.
Yeah, I just thought because he did go through a quite a big attitude change when he did do the heel turn. He changed his look and he changed his attitude and... I don't know. That kind of
might have had something to do with his medication as well. At the same time, if you catch my drift,
definitely. There's one that we actually kind of skipped over there. And Anonymous actually made a comment. I realised we just completely blew over him. But Eric Bischoff, what did you think about Bischoff turning?
It didn't make any sense to me.
No, see, to me it did. To me it did. When you have Bischoff with the group, don't get me wrong, it loses that outsider renegade tactic, and no more so from the fact that Bischoff had the. I've got contracts, you sign and you're with us, or you don't sign and you're against. I understand how it loses that sort of edgy outsider element to it then, but Bischoff to me made logical sense. I think it was a good conduit. You think, how do these guys get access to the production truck? How do they get access to the buildings come through the crowd? How do they know WCW's sort of all the little intricacies, you know? How do they get in there? How do they get that foot in the door? Bischoff being there is you know, logically it explains everything.
So looking at these groups of names, then we've just kind of run through.
Oh, go on. Luke is giggling.
Sorry,
okay, go on, Luke.
I just got at no point in any, you know, any major wrestling company at any point have ever given a shit about explaining why. You know,
I mean, that's fucking, not for you.
No. I mean, it's not that it's not for me. It's just that I'm looking back. It's like. They don't care. They never care. Who raised the suitcase? Gives a shit who raised the briefcase.
I give a shit.
We do.
That's it, though. That's it. We do. But they don't. They're not going to explain it.
Explaining things matters to me.
The Bischoff one, like you said there, you can make sense of it in the sense that they probably did need a mole character who allowed them to do all these things.
It makes sense for them to expand the group. Gene.
However, I would.
I think he claimed it on his hotline once.
He might have. The one that always bothered me the most was Sting joining the Wolfpack. I hated that.
Yeah.
That was the moment when I watched that episode.
Didn't make any
and
sense.
I just thought, after all this, Sting just joins the NWO anyway. Even if it's the babyface branch, it's like, why did you do that?
I always found it funny during that Sting run, just before he joins the Wolfpack, when he first speaks after he has to give the title back. Because a fan throws his t-shirt into the crowd, and they always think of it as that moment of, well, the Crow character spoke, I don't believe in anything anymore.
It had to be bigger than everything else before anyway, and that was part of the charm. I remember we were talking about the Nation of Domination a couple of podcasts ago, about how all these nameless, faceless guys come out of the little car, like the clowns at the circus kind of a thing. And I remember there was an episode of Nitro, I think it was one of the ones when they had the pool, where the NWO comes out of a limousine, and all of a sudden, I'm watching this tape of Nitro, I'm like, why the fuck is Big Boss Man and IRS in the NWO? Why did Scott Norton got this t-shirt on? Where did this come from?
Well, that was the thing.
The membership drive.
Yeah, the membership drive really hurt it. And I think there was a situation where it was sort of a blink and you'd miss it scenario where you think, that guy joined the NWO? When did that happen? You know, you sit there sort of scratching and think, I don't remember him joining. Yeah. Why is he there?
I will say that if we're treating it as a faction, then yeah, it's the thing. But obviously, as we mentioned earlier... with the idea of it being a brand or a separate brand, yeah, you can understand why it was getting as big as it was. It was just that I'm not entirely sure other people on the outside saw it that way.
And that's the problem. We go back to this thing where Bischoff saw it as a brand, wrestling fans saw it as a faction. And there is a disconnect there.
Yeah. There's some good comments here from Loss from Pro Wrestling Only that will probably bring a smile to your face, Carl. While Sting was set up well to be the guy, his work in 1998 left a lot to be desired. It's not a case like Hogan where he's not a Ric Flair type worker. It's that he didn't bring very much new to his act other than his look. Sting wouldn't have worked long term even if Hogan did put him over clean. That's not to say Sting shouldn't have won clean, but I think the short term money was an NWO versus NWO, more specifically Hogan Savage versus Hall and Nash. With neither side really turning babyface. That's not quite what they did. Instead, they retreaded Hogan versus Savage and then tacked Nash on as an afterthought and turned him babyface to lead his own group when they never had plans of doing a Hogan versus Nash match. That's a big key to all this.
Yeah.
Sting could have held the title for a few months and feud with WCW guys since the NWO wouldn't need the belt. That's not perfect either, though, because I don't think Goldberg beating Bret or Sting would have had the same impact that beating Hogan did. But in spite of Sting being disappointing upon his return, I don't think Hogan ever beating him was the answer either. Actually, with the benefit of hindsight, I think NWO vs. NWO should have happened completely in its own universe. There's no need to do WCW guys vs. NWO guys anymore. Starrcade would have symbolized that WCW has now won and that's it. So I probably would have had Sting drop the belt pretty quickly to Bret, while Hogan Savage come out on top of the NWO-NWO feud when the smoke clears. Then Bret vs. Hogan can be built up with Sting defending, whoever is hotter wins, and the winner drops the belt to Goldberg, and the loser is the first major challenger to put him over.
That's actually...
That's quite a long-range view there. What do you think?
It's a long-range view. I think it's an excellent view.
I think that particular last bit where he's describing a scenario of, you know... NWO versus NWO in the own universe, Sting loses to Bret, I'd probably have Bret go up against Goldberg, though I do personally hate you because you've just made Carl smile about your comments about Sting.
I know we don't have a camera right now, but I've got the biggest shit-eating grin you can imagine.
It's disgusting.
It is disgusting. I'm not sure. Goldberg, I think, did need to beat a heel. And if I don't see the problem with it. If they're going to do this NWO-NWO thing for the belt to... Because Sting was a short-term answer, I think.
The only thing I would say about an NWO-NWO feud is...
It's going to chew up so much of the scenery.
It would, but me personally, I wouldn't have... Hogan and Savage on the same side of it, and to me the focal points of it have to be Hogan and Nash.
Yeah,
yeah. Also, just because he's brought it up, and it's been brought up a couple of times now, the finger poke of Doom.
That
match.
We've completely missed the horrible reunion of the NWO, the January 4th, 1999, that was one of the big death knells in WCW.
Yeah.
There is somebody who posted some feedback that I'm not going to read, who basically tried to say that the finger poke of doom is something that smart marks look at and bury it and blah, 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 when in reality it did a 6.5 quarter or something like that. Completely ignoring the fact that the rating for that Nitro did a 5.0, and within 3 months, because of this direction, it was down to a 3.5. 2 months, my mistake.
Yeah, you know who else didn't like it? In addition to smart marks, the crowd at the Georgia Dome. And if memory serves me, within 5 months, Slamboree was at the TWA Dome.
Yeah.
Now, I may have the numbers a bit wrong here, so please correct me if this is the case, but that is an arena that could hold 60,000.
And it did exactly
what? 5 months later, they're in a situation where they've got a 60,000 seater stadium, and they can only hold it. They've only got about a third of it full.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian Knobs falls on the curtain and exposes that WCW just isn't as popular as it used to be.
And what happens at the end of 99? They're posting losses of $14 million.
Wow, oof. That's a powerful finger.
It sure is. Dester from TPWW Forums. The Monday Night War era was largely detrimental to the business long term, as is every period of hotshotting. And since the NWO was largely at the forefront of that, I could put a lot of blame on them, but the problem is much larger. Pretty interesting take there. That it kind of ties back to that week by week point that we mentioned earlier on.
We've kind of alluded to it. And I think it was an issue, but I don't think we can just use the fact that there was hotshotting as an issue. Because if that was the case, if it was solely about hotshotting, then both companies would have suffered by the time you're going through 99 and 2000. And as we clearly know, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, they definitely didn't speed through that angle, as we described the week-by-week basis of the start of the angle, and also the fact they did take their sweet time with the whole Sting match as well.
Yeah, they did start to get a little bit panicky afterwards. Yeah, they started doing things like bringing in the Warrior and all that stuff. The Brain Follower from Pro Wrestling Only. If Hogan had just done what was right and been beaten from pillar to post and pinned by Sting, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I think an NWO sans Hogan could have lasted throughout 98, but no longer than that. Slicky Tricky Damon from TPWW Forums. They ran the angle too long without making enough stars because they jobbed to the NWO left, right, and center. Sting is the only guy who really got to beat the NWO, and they fucked that up by an incompetent performance by referee Nick Patrick. Yeah. Slow count, my fucking ass. That was a three, but it shouldn't have even happened like that. Sting should have dominated Hogan and proved to be the better guy. He didn't. Also, the ending made Bret Hart look like a fucking moron and set his WCW career on the wrong foot that he never really recovered from. Heels are supposed to put the faces over. The NWO did nothing but put themselves over. They failed to put the WCW guys over. It became so bad, they had to make an NWO dissolve into a heel group and a face group. WCW didn't even matter by that point, and all the guys who fought the NWO just ended up joining the babyface wolf pack.
You know, is he surprised that the heels didn't get put the babyfaces over? when you have people like Hogan and Nash in it.
Yeah, well,
wrestling is really simple.
It is, isn't it?
When you actually look at it,
how many people fuck it up?
And it's really fucking simple. And
black hat, white hat. How else can you see it?
And I'm just thinking back because this is the first time we've really gone into depth on that Sting Hogan. I'm going to call it a match.
Yeah,
but I'm not
I did want to touch on this match because it is so pivotal.
It's everything going wrong because you've just overcomplicated every aspect of it. And
Sting pins Hogan. That's it. That's all you need.
Sting pins Hogan. The match goes no more than 10 minutes.
They tried to get greedy by creating a controversial situation so they could bring it back for Super Brawl, but.
And you don't.
But you've got too many failure points in the match they actually plan. You could do it, but you have too many
points. Too many choke points, as they say.
Yes!
And to me, Brett doesn't need to be there. You don't need Brett at Starrcade 97.
No.
You've already sold the pay-per-view off the back of Sting and Hogan. So what better way than to have Sting crush him? You get it, you're rolling into 98, and that's when Brett comes in January of 98.
Yeah. Saw from Wrestling Forum. Even when the NWO was stale, it was still often the most popular thing on the show. People tend to forget that. Go back to those early WCW 2000 events and you'll see NWO shirts. NWO are the most over thing on the show, the signs in the crowd, etc. When the NWO was really hot and fresh, it was one of the greatest storylines and factions in the history of wrestling. The negative is that it got a little stale. A little. Yeah, the positives outweigh the negatives.
I will say that being the most popular thing on the show isn't always great. The most popular thing on many episodes of TNA is not usually a good thing.
No, and I think that that's actually a really good point, because just because something was popular once doesn't mean that's the thing that should be in the here and now.
I was going to say, we're talking about the fact that there's NWO shirts in arenas in 2000 that are only half to a third full.
Exactly. Lesnar Turtle from Wrestling Forum. I don't know what that name means. As far as 90s wrestling goes, only the Austin McMahon feud can touch it, in my opinion. It elevated WCW to a whole new level and made for some of the most compelling wrestling TV ever. I actually enjoyed the Wolfpack stuff too in 1998 and didn't find it stale at all. It only really went to shit with the NWO 2000. WCW wouldn't be anywhere near as celebrated today if it wasn't for the NWO year, so the positives outweigh the negatives. NWO 2000 has got to be discussed. This was Vince Russo's ingenious idea that he'd been working really hard on.
That's really original. I've never heard it done before.
Oh, Vinnie Roo, shine on, you crazy diamond.
For anyone that's not in the know, that NWO 2000 consisted of Bret Hart, Hall, Nash, Scott Steiner, Jeff Jarrett, and the Harris Brothers.
The most worthless tag team in the history of professional wrestling.
You've
on a major
said that
league
before.
Level. Now I'm sticking to it.
You're not a fan of Eli and Jacob Blue?
No, I'm not, Carl. Neither am I a fan of Patrick and Gerald from Creative Control, Jason and Jared Grimm from the WWF. There's one for you.
Yeah, and on the subject of Harlem Heat 2000 that I heard you mention in the background there, Chase.
Come on.
Big T just looks like Ahmed Johnson after he's eaten himself.
Wow.
Oh, Lanny Poffo could do the same thing,
right? Oh. Oh, come on. I'm not getting into toss salads now.
Oh, they weren't tossing salads.
Oh, God. Oh.
Green Lawler from Wrestling Forum broke this down to pros and cons, interestingly enough. Pros: ignited the entire wrestling world to rock and wrestling era excitement. Created the Monday Night War by improving WCW and giving fans water cooler talk. Brought in thousands of casual fans and turned casual fans into devotees. Forced the WWF to try new things and step up their game. It was the greatest heel turn ever, and it was huge for merchandise. The cons: it buried too many of the WCW stars, too much power led to political, backstage, and economic problems, no exit strategy left the WCW with huge issues on many fronts. Without the NWO, it is possible the WWE does not improve, casual fans do not flock to the product, and there is no wrestling boom. I am having a hard time making the call for myself. I do believe the NWO ushered in the new boom period, but I also believe it is responsible for killing WCW and giving the WWE a monopoly. Without the NWO, could WCW still be going? It is possible, but after giving it a lot of thought, I think it would have fizzled without something amazing. So I lean towards positive, but just barely. I like that analysis.
I think it's a good analysis.
The one pro, I'll actually turn it into a pro, the one pro of the NWO was how many careers it kind of revived over a period of time. Because obviously we've talked about how it revived Hogan's career.
Yeah, very obviously.
It kept Nash and Hall relevant. It kind of gave a bit of new juice to Randy Savage and to people like Kurt Hennig, all those other guys who were kind of running by the wayside. It helped Sting develop his character, because obviously the old face paint and tights that he wore wasn't working in the mid-90s anymore, so that helped him change his character into something that was much more relevant. A lot of people benefited in some way, shape or form from the MWO, because it forced old stars to rebrand themselves, and it forced new guys to come up with the roster.
Yeah, again, big picture wise, in terms of the roster, I think at first, certainly you can say it was positive. It was just long run negative. That next generation of guys like the Benoits, the Guerreros, the Ravens, the Jerichos.
It was the Mikadas who were buried.
Yeah, those were the guys who, and Mysterio too, guys who probably should have been more than they were, but at that time were not getting any headway.
I do take a little bit of an issue with phrasing it as a burial. Some of those talent did suffer directly at the hands of the NWO. But in a lot of cases, it was simply a case of them not being allowed the opportunity, as opposed to the guys in the NWO burying them. And I think that distinction should be made. I mean, we give the key figures in the NWO enough criticism, and rightly so, for some of the things they did. But a lot of that, the talent there, weren't directly buried by the NWO. They just weren't given the chance.
I don't know if it's the actual guy, but the guy has got the scream name Barry Horowitz from Wrestling Forum. WCW was always this odd, confusing mishmash of great talent, terrible talent, classic matches, terrible booking, crossover marketing, fumbling management, and unintentional hilarity. This is great. The NWO storyline made watching WCW cool for the first time in its history and introduced a lot of people to the product, where we then got to see some of the other great things they had going for it. I turned on to see Hulk Hogan as a bad guy. Shocking! I kept watching to see the Luchadors, the Four Horsemen, the Steiner Brothers, DDP, the slow rises of Chris Benoit and Booker T towards the top of the card, my great but failed hope that Wrath would be pushed to the moon, and the like. Looking back,
I hate to admit that I had a similar hope once.
It didn't last long, but the meltdown was cool.
I was so with that email.
you went wrong. No.
Looking back, NWO was absolutely not my favourite thing about WCW, but was probably the only reason why I even gave WCW a chance. And I think that's actually a pretty interesting point when it comes to positives over negatives, and it really did introduce a lot of new viewers. Seth from TPWW Forums, the NWO was the greatest thing that ever happened until everyone was in it. Then it wasn't that special anymore. Then everyone that wasn't in it was in some joke ripoff, which ruined it even more. Then David Arquette won the title, and Vince smiled while rubbing his palms together.
which Vince?
WJD 1989 from Wrestling Forum. The last bit of feedback. I think the NWO is wrongly credited with killing WCW. Poor writing, bad creative decisions, and lack of clear leadership killed WCW. The NWO did not. The NWO was the hottest storyline of the 90s. Kickstarting the second boom of wrestling, it can't ever be possibly argued that the NWO was a negative. That's a very strong stance. Can never be argued that it was a negative.
I think ourselves and the emailers have made enough points about the fact that there were negatives there and what those negatives were.
Yeah. So, just to wrap this up, we thank you very, very much for the feedback. Going around the table, our final judgments individually, the positives and the negatives, the NWO. Luke, I'm going to throw this to you first. Sorry.
I was even portraying a thoughtful face so he wouldn't pick me. You know how you do in school, so if you don't meet the teacher's eye because they don't really want to answer the
You're looking out
question.
The window trying to think of the answer.
That's what I was doing, and then Mr. O'Rourke over there, he comes and picks on me anyway. What a prick.
Sorry, Luke. Okay, well, we're going to go with you anyway. So, fuck off.
Answer the fucking question.
This conversation's really helped me actually get a bit more of a handle on it. The positive and negative of the NWO to me comes down to where you draw the line on what the NWO is. There's a lot of negatives I perceive in WCW that come from the members of the NWO.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. But do you blame that on the NWO itself? You remove the NWO angle, they're still there.
Yeah.
You know, they're still fucking there. It doesn't change that. How many people were hired purely for the angle that made any real difference? I mean, you know what I mean? It's the core troublesome guys, they were there regardless of the NWO and regardless of the angle. Now, it's certainly possible to say that they wouldn't have had so much pull if they weren't a major part of this major faction, which is this major angle. So I suppose it is certainly a credit to that. And there's that issue. Having discussed this, with you guys today. WCW was in many ways between a rock and a hard place. There are a lot of the negatives that come from the NWO to do with its lifespan, but as we've discussed here, it was not going to be something they could safely stop in that scenario at that time, right up until the end. In my opinion, from what we discussed, I can see their train of thought on that. It's a terrible way of looking at things, and frankly, it's a terrible way of doing long-term business.
Yeah.
But they weren't thinking long-term, okay? And as we look at it now, the long-term legacy of the NWO, good or bad, well, it's... every faction these days has something that can link back to the NWO. That's not always something that they do consciously. Okay? I would open it a little further and say every faction these days has something that links back to the NWO or the Horsemen. I mean, generally speaking, you look at any faction since then, it's leaning towards one of those two in a lot of different aspects. The wrestling world would be a very, very different place without that angle. The point that keeps coming up again and again and again in the comments is Vince wouldn't have felt the pressure to change without the NWO. And I think that is one thing we have direct evidence of today. Because we've gone 10 years with no change.
Yeah.
No change of direction, yeah. No nothing. Because he has a very small reason. He's got that PG-13 reason, those action figures, those things, that want to keep him PG-13. Just a minor thing. This is Vince fucking McMahon. If he wanted to change direction, he'd just fucking do it.
Yeah,
okay? This
care.
Is Vince McMahon. But he has no reason to, and he hasn't. And just because of that, I think that is solid enough evidence to say no NWO. Because ECW, yeah, Vince took a lot from ECW, but ECW on its own was never going to change the course and change the mind of Vince McMahon, ever. But the NWO did that, and it gave us the Attitude Era, it gave us the popularity of wrestling, and that's it, that's what it comes down to. And I didn't think I'd be coming in to say that, but that is wrestling... It's not just that wrestling wouldn't be what it is today, but it wouldn't be what it was when I loved it.
Yeah, I think that's...
Okay? Because what it is today... What it is today is not what was made by the NWO. What it is today is probably what it'd be if there was no NWO.
Yeah.
I mean, we've just kind of reverted to that because we're playing it safe and nobody gives a shit. We'll just rake that money in. No competition. No NWO. No change to the Attitude Era. No creation of the wrestling that I loved. And no reason for me to be on this podcast talking to you wonderful people in my beautiful tone of voice. Thank you. And good night.
I'm really, really fucking grateful I've got to follow that. Thanks a lot. I'm really regretting the fact that I gave you that word authenticity now. The cat's out of the bag. Fuck it. I came up with that word, not you. It's hard to disagree with anything that Luke has said there. I'm not even going to try. I'm not even going to try and talk.
It's not
it.
A trial yet.
It was on the money. It was very articulate and very accurate. We can talk about the bust of WCW as much as we want to. But without the NWO, there's no real boom. So for that reason alone, and for all the reasons that Luke has already underscored, to me, it was more of a positive than a negative.
Yeah, it's really hard to follow what Luke said. He absolutely did it perfectly. I mean, we just spent like a good part of an hour just talking, and then right at the very end, Luke comes in with his own finger poke of doom and just fucked us all over. It's just amazing. Oh, yeah. And just steals every single thing I was thinking and more. He actually inserted stuff. It's like Inception from a retrospective point of view. The NWO in itself, in its own little universe, is kind of like a game of two halves. When you kind of look at the beginning of it, and, you know, we talked about this earlier in the podcast about how hot it was for those first several weeks and how it was for, like, at least the first year, there was some great stuff. I mean, that angle raised the game of everybody in that company. But once you get past the crapness of Starrcade 97, that's when the second side of the story comes along and we start to really see the negatives. Again, harping back to what Luke said, he's absolutely right. It's the one thing, the main thing, that we're missing in wrestling today. We need something, not exactly, but something like the NWO to galvanize everybody so that they can raise their performance just like NWO forced everybody else to raise theirs.
TNA. TNA.
Oh, God.
You have soiled this episode.
Oh, literally. Brown stain. Okay. the NWO is such an interesting angle. You're always, from a personal experience, you always harken back, at least personally, to your own experience of witnessing it and just being so obsessed with the angle and loving it so much and being captivated by the concept and everything like that. It wasn't the only great thing about WCW at the time, and I think that's kind of one of the things that's a little bit lost sometimes, is that it wasn't just the NWO. Well, the NWO was obviously the thing that drew the money, but there was so much to enjoy about the WCW product, and I think that it really shone a big neon light on the fact that, you know what, WCW is really damn good right now. And there were, it wasn't a perfect product either. Nothing ever is. But at the same time, like I said, a lot of the feedback there, a lot of the comments was revolving around what it did for the WWF. But for WCW itself, I mean, a lot of what brought people's attention to World Championship Wrestling, where you got a bit of this in the feedback, is the fact that the NWO angle was so different and so unique, and the angles they did with guys coming through the crowd, smashing the commentary tables, beating guys in the back with baseball bats, going to the production truck, the who's going to join the NWO, the who's on whose side. This element of wrestling was so exciting that even though it did have its problems towards the end, like everybody's made such a good case for, those were problems that were inherent in the company before the NWO even began. They were always going to be there. Ultimately, the positives do outweigh the negatives for me. I don't think the NWO is what's responsible for WCW's death by any stretch of the imagination. It was salvageable when the angle was dead, and it just wasn't salvaged correctly. They went back to the NWO. Actually, that's probably a pretty bad point to make, but you know what I'm saying? But you know what I mean? When it was actually finished, they could have saved it, and then they went back to the same old, same old. And it wasn't the NWO, it was the decision makers who felt like it was the pat hand. Just like any angle that exhausts its lifespan.
Certainly the casual fans who watched WCW only in that era, not before, not after, mainly because there wasn't anything after, that's what they remember as the NWO. Yeah. So, legacy-wise...
Yeah, and I think that pretty much sums it up, Luke, with the final word. And I think after that first speech, I think that's perfectly just. For G. John Chase, whose side is he on? For Carl Jones,
I think I still have one more beer left.
And for Luke Edwards,
I took over.
Yes, he did.
I'm Liam O'Rourke. Thank you very much for listening. You can subscribe to us on iTunes if you haven't already, and we are out of here.